I'm very interested in the processes by which intelligent and insightful scientists, people like yourself, Richard Dawkins, or the late Stephen Jay Gould, or even Kenneth Miller, can look at the world and come to such different conclusions about the relationship of faith and science. Could you describe your process, how you came to that?
Well, my view of faith and science, as I'll be explaining in my talk tomorrow, is that they're incompatible, indeed antagonistic on many fronts, because they both purport to be ways of seeking the truth, but only one of them, i.e. science, has a means of actually finding the truth. I was raised as a secular Jew. There's an old joke that what do you call a Jew who doesn't believe in God? And the answer is a Jew. I mean, mostly liberal Jews are not believers by and large, and so I wasn't inculcated with God. I think that sort of immunized me against any kind of faith that would impinge on me in my later life. So when I became a scientist, and that is a godless profession, I never needed to even consider the possibility of God, even though I went to college in William & Mary, which is, you know, in Southern Virginia. It's a fairly religious area, where I sort of became more active in opposing religion and talking about its incompatibility with science was when I became an evolutionary biologist and started teaching it. And as you know, evolution is not accepted by most Americans. 46% of them reject it, 40% accept it, and the rest are sort of on the fence. And so I tried to teach evolution, wrote a book about it, hoping to convince people by giving them the facts, the multifarious facts that support evolution, that it was true and there was no reason to oppose it. And my book, and I think my teaching has been somewhat successful in that respect, but I realized that it didn't have a huge effect on people's beliefs, particularly my book. And if you look at the acceptance of evolution in this country over the last 50 years, it's been pretty flat. It's been about 40%. And that's despite the fact that we've had people like Carl Sagan, Steve Gould, Richard Dawkins, all these people, you know, I hate to use the word preaching about it, but giving the evidence for it. And then I suddenly realized that religion is the problem. It's not ignorance. It's not that people don't know the evidence for evolution. It's that they won't accept it because of religious blinkers. Because evolution is sort of the one area of science that hits religious people in the solar plexus. They don't have any problem with germs, germ theory of disease, or atoms, or cosmology, but they do have a problem with evolution. And I realized that we're not going to make headway, or I'm not going to make headway in getting Americans to accept evolution unless we, you know, sort of lessen the grip of religion on it. And the reason that we have this antagonism is because science and religion are indeed incompatible, at war with each other, especially in the area I work in, evolution.
It's interesting to bring up that statistic about acceptance of evolution and use that word accept, not believe, accept. I always thought it was partly a problem of language. I mean, because one of the more common arguments, if you can call it that, that I hear is, well, it's only a theory. I would imagine you'd have to kind of back people and go, look, scientists don't use the word theory to mean a guess.
Yeah.
And do you think that that dichotomy of you know, science using a very precise language versus an imprecision of daily speech, is that a factor in that?
No, I don't think it's a factor in people not accepting evolution. It's something they seize on to deny evolution. And there's many things they seize on because they just don't like it. I mean, they'll use any trick in the book to claim that evolution and science in general is a fallible enterprise, including using the word faith and belief.
Right.
You know, science is based on faith. Science is just a belief, when they know very well that it's a very different kind of thing. No, I mean, the real reason they don't like evolution is because it goes against what the Bible says. It makes humans seem not special. It dispels the myth of Adam and Eve. It you know, takes humans away from their status as God's special creation. There's all these real reasons why they don't like evolution.
Right.
And then they seize on things like these word tricks, faith, belief, et cetera, as reasons to go after science. So.
Do you think it's a uniquely Christian problem? It seems as though after a certain point, Christianity kind of locked on to a literal interpretation of that and built everything else, well, especially particularly fundamentalist Christianity, kind of built everything else on it from there. Do you see it as something that is broadly based? I do know that there's Christianism is an issue in Turkey.
Yeah, Muslims, in fact, have a big problem with evolution. Most Muslims just reject it, or else they'll try to comport it with the Quran and say it was all anticipated in the Quran. But by and large, you know, Islamic countries, with the exceptions of some of the liberal ones, and surprisingly, Iran, there's an exception, will not teach evolution. They just reject it as a Western scientific thing. I mean, the problem is Islam does not have a sophisticated theology in which a lot of people are devoted to try to reconciling science or interpreting the scripture. In fact, in Islam, it's sort of heretical to interpret the Quran. It's supposed to be taken literally. There's no liberal theology of the Quran. So, you know, you either buy evolution or you don't, but you don't twist the Quran to make it seem like it could accept evolution the way Christianity does.
Do you think that there's a problem with it in Torah and Tanakh for Jews?
Yeah, Orthodox Jews don't buy evolution either. I've met the real Orthodox. I mean, you know, there's several sects of Judaism,
right.
Liberal, I mean, sorry, Reform, Conservative, and right. Orthodox, and the Orthodox don't buy it. I was at the amazing meeting, the James Randi meetings in Las Vegas a couple of months ago, and I met there two ex-Orthodox Jews who both had the same story. They came up to me independently and said, well, you know, I was brought up in an Orthodox household, and I was told, I mean, they are biblical literalists, that evolution was not something that was, you know, kosher, so to speak. And, you know, and both of them had the same story. Well, I wanted to learn more about the arguments of my opponents so I could counter them more effectively. So they started reading Dawkins and evolution, and then they realized that, hey, there's some truth to this stuff. And eventually they left the faith. And as is the norm, when they did that, they were completely rejected by their family and their Orthodox friends and things, and they became atheists. So, yeah, and some of my biggest critics are Orthodox Jews. From the Discovery Institute, for example, in Seattle, the Intelligent Design. There's another rabbi, I can't remember his name, who goes after me regularly. But, of course, you know, Christians are the ones that have the population, and they also have all, I mean, there's so many branches of Christianity, so many more than there is of Judaism, that they have devoted the most effort to trying to comport science with religion or find ways to reject science.
Well, there's a quote you have in the beginning of Why Evolution is True from Charles Darwin on the Origin of Species, and I think it's an amazing quote. I just read it out here. There is a grandeur in this view of life, with its several powers having been originally breathed into a few forms or into one, and that whilst this planet has gone cycling on according to the fixed law of gravity, from so simple a beginning, endless forms most beautiful and wonderful have been and are being evolved. I always get stuck on that word grandeur. Well, the word grandeur and the word breathed, Darwin's use of those terms. Do you think that he could be admitting some sense of something beyond himself, not necessarily someone, but something beyond himself, a spirituality, not a religion or religiosity, but a certain metaphysics?
Well, that is God if you're talking about breathed. I mean, if you're talking about breathed, I mean, that's an anthropomorphization of something that actually gave some vitalistic force. Well, you could be a vitalist, I suppose, and imply that there's some metaphysical force driving evolution. But all the evidence is that Darwin was, if not an atheist, and he never would have admitted that because his wife was religious, was a non-believer. I think he used the word breathed metaphorically in that sense. You know, life started. And he might have done it as a bit of a slap to his believers. I'm not sure about this, but I think that he regretted using that word later because it gave some credence to religion. And really, Darwin, there's not an inkling of evidence that Darwin had any kind of belief in God or personal God after he came back to England and started writing his, you know, great books, his 11 or 12 books after that. So the word grandeur, I don't think at all has anything to do with the numinous or spiritual. I mean, I feel that same grandeur. It's just every time I look at an animal, and I mean, you get inured to this, but if you just look at a squirrel running across the quads and you think about it for a minute, you think, well, you know, that squirrel came from a 3-billion-year history starting with just dirt, basically, and soup. And it has all these amazing adaptations, biochemical, behavioral, morphological, to react to the environment. It's an independent creature, and it all came through this materialistic process. Mm-hmm. And to me, and I think to Richard Dawkins as well, and this is, of course, what he's devoted his life to promulgating, is that that really is grandeur. Hmm. I mean, you can say it makes you feel spiritual. I hate to use that word because it plays into the hand of religious people. But right. It does give you a certain amazement and wonder that this has really happened on our planet. And I think another, just thinking about what you said, another piece of evidence that Darwin saw this as a naturalistic process, and the word breathed. I mean, look, if you're going to be a metaphorical liberal Christian, then you're going to believe metaphor. You could say, well, Darwin used the word breathe as metaphor. But he's drawing an explicit analogy in that paragraph between the planets and circling around the sun as a consequence of pure physical law and evolution as a pure physical law. I mean, I think that sense of grandeur that Darwin felt is the same one that we feel, that just the laws of physics acting on inanimate matter could give rise to the diversity of species we have today.
Something from the very arrangement of the planets in the heavens down to the smallest creature on the planet.
Yeah, I think he was doing this as an explicit bit of rhetoric. I mean, Darwin's rhetorical abilities are often ignored. He called his book One Long Argument, and if you read it, you'll see that he's building up to this conclusion, which is in the last paragraph. But he starts off with very mundane things like pigeon breeding and animal breeding, and yet he uses these rhetorical devices like, well, you know, maybe you have this objection to my argument, but let me answer it here. So he's always taking the reader's part and sort of having this long argument with himself that culminates in the conclusion, which you just read.
Well, do you think that Stephen Jay Gould's idea of non-overlapping magisteria and Kenneth Miller's Roman Catholicism, do you see that as somehow impairing science?
Yeah, I do, actually. I mean, if they kept it to themselves, that's one thing. Mm-hmm. But they don't.
Miller's written about it.
Gould has this very famous book, Rocks of Ages. I'll be talking a little about that tomorrow evening. Well, let me talk about Gould first. Sure. I mean, Gould's Rocks of Ages, which is a very, very popular book, and his strategy, which is called Noma, or for non-overlapping magisteria, is very popular for accommodationists, people trying to comport science and religion, is that the proper sphere of religion is meaning and morals and values. And the proper sphere of science is to understand the cosmos around us. And he claimed, not just as a should argument, but as an is argument, that religion occupies one sphere and science occupies the other. So they're concerned with different kinds of questions. And I would even object to that on several grounds. First of all, religion does not occupy itself solely with meanings, morals, and values. It makes epistemic statements about what's real in the universe, i.e. God, he sent his son Jesus down, you're not going to get saved unless you're baptized, you know. And if you believe scripture, then there's a lot of other scientifically testable statements in there, like there was the Exodus from, you know, Egypt, which has been disproven, that there was Genesis and the Great Flood, which has been disproven. So all religions at bottom, with the possible exception of things like Buddhism, are based on statements about reality, not just meaning, morals, and values, which are an important part of religion, to be sure. But without those epistemic statements, what you have left is just humanism. You know, you have ethics. So it has to be based on God, and it has to be based on the idea that there really is some transcendent being, which is a statement that in principle is scientifically testable.
So it gets closer to the kind of deism you see in Jefferson's Bible.
Well, yeah, that's the only kind of religion that is, I think, compatible with science, is to say that there was some kind of God, there is some kind of numinous disembodied thing, but he's never had anything to do with the universe. But then that's a meaningless religion.
Right.
There are no real deists in that sense, unless those people that say metaphorically, well, nature is my God or love is my God. That's fine. You know, if you want to call something that doesn't do anything God. But, you know, the vast majority of people, and certainly the vast majority of Americans, are theists and think that God interacts with the world. The other problem with Gould's thesis is that besides religion obstinately refusing to remain in the bounds of meanings, morals, and values, is that there's a whole secular tradition of meanings, morals, and values, starting with ancient Greeks, in which you derive your morality from rationality and discussion and consideration without any mention of God. And, you know, so that's a problem. Gould even takes up the idea, what about, you know, Christianity that's creationist? which explicitly obtrudes into science. And he says, well, that's not real religion. He does. He says those aren't proper religions. He doesn't just say that they shouldn't be doing it. He says these aren't religions per se. And by so doing, he disenfranchises the vast majority of believers in this country. So his argument is a non-starter, and I think it's been rejected, and rejected more by theologians than by scientists, I think, because they see, you know, the problem with, you know, just saying, well, all we deal with is meaning, morals, and values and not truth. So Miller is a little bit more problematic. I mean, I like Ken. He's written a great biology textbook. He has been a great ally in the fight against creationism with his books and his testimony in the Dover trial against intelligent design. But yet, he enables superstition in ways that you can see by reading his books. He says, for example, that he thinks the universe is fine-tuned, that the parameters of physics, you know, the fine structure constant, the relative weights of neutrons and protons and stuff, it's inexplicable why those values take those values unless God did it to make us here. This is called the anthropic principle. Now, physicists don't know why the laws of physics are what they are, but to say that, well, they are what they are because they're God is simply the old God of the gaps argument, right, if you don't understand something. So although both Ken Miller and Francis Collins say we don't like these God of the gaps arguments, they're bad science, they're bad theology, they actually both use them in their own work. You know, so, and I also think that, I mean, the last thing I'll say about this is that people like Miller, who can be a scientist from Monday through Saturday and then go to Mass on Sunday, are fundamentally suffering from a form of cognitive dissonance, and that their enabling of religion through their own writings gives support to those other religionists who do bad things. The Catholic Church, of which Ken is a member, and I'm not saying he believes every tenet they have, is responsible for a lot of hideous things in this world. Opposition to homosexuality, opposition to abortion, opposition to condom use, birth control, intrusion into people's sex lives, terrifying of children with thoughts of hell. That's the Catholic Church, you know. And every time you are a Catholic and you say that, you know, you believe in the tenets of Catholicism, that's the kind of stuff you're promoting, even if indirectly.
How do you debate a theist? I mean, it seems as though that you're arguing evidence against a subjective truth. It'd be like trying to eat Jell-O with a baseball bat.
Or nail Jell-O to the wall. Yeah. Well, it depends on who the theist is. I've really only debated two of them, one a Catholic and one of them a liberal Lutheran. And you have to study what they say and go after what they say. But I think the most effective tactic to debate a theist is to just to ask them the simple question, how do you know that you're right and all the other religions are wrong? They can't answer that. They never can answer it. Because at bottom, all religions are based on either where you were brought up, what you were taught, or some revelation that you've had inside your head. And there's no reasonable philosophical thing anybody can say that's convincing about how I know I'm right and how you know you're wrong. So that, you know, you have to ask them these very hard questions. When I debated the Lutheran, and that was in Charleston about 6 months ago, she was a Lutheran whose church holds that anybody who's not baptized is going to hell. Hmm. So I asked her, well, I'm an atheist, secular Jew. You think I'm going to hell? She would not give a straight answer. So that's the main problem with theologians and theology in general, is that they waffle. You know, and it's like you said, it's like trying to hit Jell-O with a baseball bat.
Well, it's almost as if they don't want to tell you. They'll say it in general.
Yeah, but they won't tell you. I mean, this is a problem. It's a problem of hypocrisy. Mm-hmm. I mean, some churches have this, and this was pointed out by the philosopher Walter Kaufman, that they have this double strategy. Sort of, you know, people like Kierkegaard have a very liberal view of religion, but also talk to other people as well, that when they're with the liberals, they'll say one thing. When they're with the other people, they'll say the other thing. So when I asked her, am I going to go to hell, she just basically waffled and gibbered and said, well, you know, hell means different things to different people. And, you know, but her church's document, I pointed this out, say explicitly, you're going to burn in the fires of hell if you're not baptized. There's no metaphorical interpretation possible of that. So, but they're good at this kind of circumlocution. That's one of the reasons I don't like to debate theologians in general. you know.
Because they're hard to argue. I mean,
they're hard to argue with because they don't give you straight answers. If you want to see an example of this, there's a YouTube video where Richard Dawkins and Sam Harris argue with two liberal rabbis. One of them is named David Wolpe, mm-hmm. and I can't remember who the other one is. But these guys are so liberal that they're like a hair's breadth from being atheists. And they just go back and forth. And, you know, Dawkins says, well, what do you really believe? And, you know, they can't really pin it down or they don't want to say it. But you have a feeling it in your heart. And that's another thing. And that's a problem with scientists like Ken Miller, not necessarily with Collins, is that they won't admit what they really can believe about religion. Hmm. If you ask these people, do you believe that Jesus came back from the dead or that he was born of a virgin, they'll waffle. They'll say, this is a private matter to me and I don't see why I need to discuss it. The reason being that if they admit they really believe this stuff, they lose credibility with their fellow scientists. Hmm. If they admit they don't believe it, they lose credibility with the church.
In tomorrow night's presentation, are you going to have a Q&A portion? And if you are, do you expect any feedback, any blowback?
Oh, lots, yeah. I mean, I will have a Q&A, and I hope it goes on for at least an hour. I mean, that's my favorite part because, you know, I know my lecture, but I don't learn anything from it. Right. But what you do learn from is crossing sabers with those who don't believe in you. And so there will be a Q&A, and I hope it will be long. And I expect, based on what I know of Murray State and what I know so far is that about 2/3 of the posters that have been put up advertising this talk have been defaced by students. I have pictures of them. I'll post them on my blog. They rip holes in them. They stick holes in my eyes or rip off pieces and stuff like that. There's a lot of opposition to just the title of my talk. In fact, I got an email from a student here saying, you know, we don't like the title of your talk, and that's why your posters are being defaced. And we don't like the Murray State Secular Organization either. So, the only other time I faced this kind of stuff was also in Kentucky when I lectured in the University of Kentucky at Lexington. Mm-hmm. And there, the Christian students took down all the posters advertising my talk. This was not an anti-theology talk. This is just straight evolution talk. So the students had to go back and replace all the posters. You can go over to the big building,
Faculty Hall?
Faculty Hall. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the posters, about 2/3 of the ones advertising my talk have holes punched in them, tears on them, ripped out and stuff. And so the secular students had to go around and put labels on some of them saying, look, before you deface this poster, ask yourself, what would Jesus do? Apparently that stops the vandalism. But
not many people know that John T. Scopes of the monkey trial, as H.L. Mencken called it, was born in Paducah, grew up in Paducah, and is buried in Paducah, Oak Grove Cemetery. Do you think, when you consider the echoes the Scopes trial has had, like Epperson versus Arkansas in 68, Kitzmiller versus Dover Area Schools in 2005.
McLean versus Arkansas, yeah.
Right. And do you think that he has had some kind of influence on the debate?
You mean Scopes per se, as a person?
Yes.
Well, that was the beginning of formalized opposition to creationism in America. I mean, Scopes lost his case, on a technicality. The judge levied the fine instead of the jury. But so the law, the Butler Act, was not overturned. But that was the beginning of legal challenges to creationism in America. So he was a forerunner. I mean, but it's also shown that he was, you know, well, first of all, he lost. So the Butler Act, which forbade the teaching, by the way, of human evolution only, not of evolution, but of human evolution, which shows the religious sort of wellsprings of this kind of law, that it hasn't worked. It just keeps coming back, you know, like those little rubber clowns. I don't know if they have them for kids anymore, but you'd punch them and they'd come back up again. That's what creationism is in America. If you punch it, biblical creationism down, it comes back up as scientific creationism. Epperson versus Arkansas. You punch that down, those cases were lost. It comes back as intelligent design. Punch that down, as they did in the Dover trial, and they lost there. It comes back as, well, let's just teach the problems with evolution, which is what's going on now in lots of states. So,
Do you think that signals some kind of retreat? Because it sounds like they're stepping further and further and further back from overt religiosity and more into, well, the best we can hope to do now is just try to poke a hole in it or make a crack somewhere.
Yeah, it's a philosophical – it's a tactical retreat, not a philosophical one. I mean, if you see the Wedge document, which was written by the Discovery Institute, an intelligent design think tank, I think about 20 years ago, a little less than that, they have this strategy planned out where they go after materialism and naturalism. And after they soften us up by getting rid of that, then they start bringing religion into the classroom. So I think that's what we're saying. I mean, it's a temporary retreat. But if they get these laws passed that actually, you know, make teachers talk about the supposed problems with evolutionary biology and global warming as well, that just opens the stage for putting more and more religion into it. I've been told by several people since I've been here in less than 24 hours that evolution is not taught at Murray in the high schools here, that the teachers just won't do it. I mean, that's a violation. It's not a violation of law not to teach it. It would be a violation to teach creationism or to diss evolution, but it's shortchanging the kids who live in this town. Mm-hmm. And if there's any listeners out there that are hearing this, I would investigate this, because if you don't teach kids about evolution and biology, you're keeping from them the most encompassing and exciting theory in biology. It underpins everything else in biology, and to not teach it on religious grounds is simply unconscionable in my view. I was also told that in another county, I think maybe where Paducah is, there was a law for a while that the evolution pages in the textbooks had to be glued together. And that was true, and for a while, I think they've rescinded that law. But that's the nature of what's going on. It's a shame.
Which is weird. I took biology in high school at a Catholic high school, mm-hmm. and we were taught about evolution.
Yeah, well, Catholics are pretty much down with evolution. Mm-hmm. I mean, the official pronouncement of, I think, is Pope John. First, Pope Pius sort of opened the door a little bit, and then Pope John says, well, we don't have a problem with evolution, except for the soul. Mm-hmm. Human evolution is sort of an exception. So I don't really like that a lot, because it makes humans different from other animals. And if there's anything that Darwin and the rest of us accept, it's purely naturalistic process. There's no souls inserted. Some lineages, but by and large, Catholics do teach evolution, and the Catholic school in places like Kentucky is where you're going to learn about evolution. Nevertheless, in the Paducah Public High School, you don't learn about evolution. And I'm also told here at Murray State that evolution is not a required course for biology majors, which I consider a shame. I mean, it is the foundational theory of biology, and I can't see any reason not to make it required. Except for religious reasons.
Well, I presume then that you take some degree of heart from the fact that the latest numbers that I've seen breaking down religious identification in the United States, the numbers of agnostics and atheists are approaching 20%, among adults at least.
Yeah. Yeah, I take heart in that. I mean, I think it's inevitable that this country will become like Northern Europe eventually, that is largely a secular country in which we may get baptized and married in churches, but purely as a form of ritual. Mm-hmm. I mean, that, by the way, shows that religion is not necessary for a well-functioning country. By many standards, places like Denmark, Sweden, and Norway, the Scandinavian countries, and even France are better functioning than America in terms of taking care of the most dispossessed citizens. And yet they're largely atheistic countries. Mm-hmm. 85% of, I think, Danes are atheists, and they're just as moral, they're more moral than Americans. They take care of the old people, they have state medical care, and they have meals for old people, and they take, a great network of social support. So the statement that religion will always be with us and will never disappear from America because we need it is not one I think that's supported by looking at the rest of the world.
So you think there are children born today that will see a majority agnostic or atheist?
I think it's going to take longer than that in this country. And the main reason is because I think religion, I'll talk about this a bit tomorrow, that religion itself doesn't spring from nothing. I'm not a Marxist, but I think Marx got it right when he said, it's the opium of the people, it's the sigh of the oppressed masses. And there's a lot of sociological evidence to back up the contention that in countries where people aren't doing too well, when they're low on the social scale of how well off you are in terms of income, incarceration, corruption, medical care, and things, they turn to religion I mean, there's lots and lots of evidence of this. Religion, when income inequality rises, that is, people, you know, the difference between the rich and the poor becomes greater, religiosity rises a year later. And so you can see these trends following each other. And it's because people largely become religious as a way of dealing with the hardship in their lives, as a way of thinking, well, it will all be set right in the next world, or I have Jesus as my friend. And so in order to get rid of religion, and I don't mean to, by that, shooting religious people, but to loosen its grip in this country, I think that we're going to have to improve ourselves socially first. And that gets rid of the need that people have for religion. You know, and I think that's why, I mean, you can see this correlation very clearly across the world, that those countries on the sociological scale that are healthy sociologically in terms of income, medical care, low suicides, low prenatal mortality, et cetera, those are the countries that are the least religious. It's the most religious countries that are the most socially dysfunctional. And unfortunately, the U.S. ranks high on the social dysfunction scale. So we're right there with Turkey and Saudi Arabia and countries like that where we're very religious and we're not doing too well in terms of taking care of everybody.
Well, I wonder how that is going to play out. I mean, because there's this American sense of exceptionalism, that this is the shining city on a hill, as one of the early Puritan preachers put it, and how that is going to make it difficult for people to turn loose of that.
Well, they have in some senses already. You know, we think that we're an exceptionalist because we have a lot of money.
Right.
We have a lot of people. We have a lot of brain power. We have a lot of technology and might. But, you know, if you look at things like how many babies die during childbirth or how many citizens get medical care, we're not exceptionalistic, except that we're at the bottom, right, you know, compared to other countries like Britain or France or Europe. So I think that we – and, you know – Medicare and Social Security were attempts to rectify this kind of social imbalance. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think that's the way the country will go. There's also the increasing morality of Americans, which comes from secularism, the recognition that women and gays and other dispossessed people need to be treated equally and given more rights. That comes not from religion by and large, but is opposed by religion by and large. That's heartening as well. What's disheartening is this opposition to Obamacare, which is just an attempt to get people who don't have medical care. I mean, maybe they've gone about it the wrong way and everything, but to call it socialism, to oppose it on grounds that, you know, it's profoundly anti-American is just dumb in my view. I mean, if Obamacare is socialism, and so is Social Security, so is Medicare, so is Medicaid, and those have been great things for our country. So I think we need to keep going in that direction. I mean, this is politics, not religion, but when we do go in that direction, I think we'll become eventually like Denmark or Sweden. We'll have a good support network. People will not be dispossessed, and people won't need religion anymore.